Welcome to the Fund the People podcast. I'm your host, Rusty Stahl. I'm president and CEO of Fund the People, where our mission is to maximize investment in America's nonprofit workforce. We give funders and nonprofits cutting-edge ideas, research, and tools to help drive equity, effectiveness, and endurance in the social sector. So let's start the show. Welcome, everybody, to the Fund the People podcast. Thanks for listening. Today, I'm really excited. We've got an amazing guest, Akilah Watkins. Let me tell you a little bit about her. Dr. Akilah Watkins is president and CEO of Independent Sector. She joined the organization in that capacity on January 17th, 2023. Previously, Dr. Watkins was the president and CEO for the Center for Community Progress, America's nonprofit leader for turning vacant spaces into vibrant places, a 25-year national thought leader, conference speaker, and nonprofit executive. Akilah's work began at the age of 14 when she led efforts to convert a vacant lot and abandoned home into a community center in Roosevelt, New York. Since then, she served as an executive leader for nonprofits and community development initiatives, including work with the Obama administration, Neighborhood Works, Robert Wood Johnson, Ford Foundation, and the Center for the Study of Social Policy. Akilah is an amazing leader, and I'm really excited for you to hear from her. So here is my conversation with Dr. Akilah Watkins. So, Akilah Watkins, welcome to the Fund the People podcast. Thank you for making time to be here.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Rusty, for the invitation.
Absolutely. We met when you were a program officer at the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. I was at Emerging Practitioners in Philanthropy, which was trying to get a chapter going in Atlanta. So I wanted to give a quick shout out to Lynetta Gilbert for supporting EPIP to work in the South, and a shout out to Milano Hardin for his work organizing our work in Atlanta back then. So I'm so glad we got to meet then. And now you are president and CEO of the Independent Sector. So congratulations on your relatively new role in this leadership position for the sector. And thank you again for your work and for being here.
Thank you so much, Rusty. And those were great times in Atlanta, building philanthropic social movements with young people coming from different backgrounds. It was an exciting time.
Yeah, it was. And it's just amazing to also still be in community and relationship with folks from then. And it just shows that, you know, when you stick with something over the long haul, that people you connect with at one point kind of weave in and out of your life over time. And that's just, it's very rewarding, I think, at least for me, that's how I feel. So yeah, I was excited to have you come on and kind of add your perspective to the conversation we've been building here on this podcast and at Fund the People overall. I thought we could just kick off, though, by sharing a little bit more about yourself and what motivated your nonprofit and philanthropic career. If you can kind of give us a little bit of the arc of your career, what got you started and sort of how do you see yourself moving and shifting through time?
First of all, that's an amazing question. Moving and shifting through time in and of itself can be an hour. But to the former question about sort of how did I get started? First of all, let me just say, this is some of the most rewarding work, you know, I'm doing in my life. And I'm so deeply grateful for the opportunity to do this work. I got started working in community. I was 14 years old. I was a young person. I lived outside of New York City by that time. My family moved to the suburbs of New York in Long Island, like a lot of families at the time did, leaving, you know, the inner cities of this country and moving to the suburbs for a better life for their children. And my parents were the same. And so living in a suburb of New York City we still were plagued with a lot of the same issues that my parents thought they were leaving. And at 14, I got an opportunity to change that and created a summer program in my neighborhood, because when I was 14, I wanted to get a job. I wanted to work. I wanted to contribute to society. And there wasn't a lot of opportunities in the neighborhood that I lived in. And I lived in a Black working class, middle class neighborhood. And so I thought that was deeply unfair and decided to get with some of my friends at the time. We were all in junior high, and we found some community adults that were willing to chaperone us. And we started a summer youth program. And that summer youth program grew into some of the most impactful work that I can imagine doing as a young person. I actually worked at my organization for 8 years. So I named it IAM Corporation. We had a lot of young people, and it was a youth entrepreneurial program. And we did everything from running after-school programs focused on African-American males, African-American females, all the way to taking over a community vacant building, which is going to be another theme that comes later on in my life, taking over a vacant building and actually creating a community youth center out of it. So, I was always very radical, never sort of going through the normal process of how you do things, but deeply impactful. So that's how I started.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, sounds like you were a practical radical too. You were making things happen in the here and now, as well as looking out to the future. So, well, tell us, give us a snapshot of where you went as an adult in your career, because you clearly started your career before you were an adult.
Yeah. So I worked at local community grassroots organization that I started when I was 14 years old till I was like 22. And Rusty, if I can be honest with you and your guest, it was time to leave. Grassroots work is some of the hardest work you'll ever do. And my adult mentor at the time, she passed away. She was 47 years old. And that year, I actually lost two Black women that were deeply important to me. And they both died, and they were very young. They were my age or younger. And part of the reason why they passed, and this was, I think, a turning point in my life, is because they both worked in the nonprofit sector doing amazing grassroots work, but didn't have the healthcare benefits, didn't have the time off to go to the doctor, and, all the proper insurance to go. So I experienced this firsthand. And I think when they passed and I buried them, that, I took some time off, decided to really sort of heal from that. And I moved, and when I moved to Atlanta. And I think working at the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta under the leadership of Leslie Grady and Alicia Phillips was really, I think, an important moment for me, because, again, so much of my creation story was built in community with community residents, particularly Black and Brown community residents, because I lived in a community that was really demographically changing. And so that was my life for years on end. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of shifted and moved into working at the Community Foundation, where I'm working with very wealthy donors from around the region of Atlanta, and being at the Community Foundation where we were building the endowment, really sort of revving it up. So it was just such an interesting time, but that was such a pivotal moment. And I'm always deeply grateful for Atlanta, because a lot of people aren't able to transition from working in deep grassroots sort of spaces and transition to working at a place that's a lot more sort of formal and structured, like the Community Foundation. And I was able to do so even while I was scared.
I appreciate you sharing that, and such an important part of your story that I didn't know. All right. Well, it's hard to transition from that, but let's bring our listeners up to date. So you've transitioned from that grassroots work into philanthropic foundation work, and then you focused on housing issues and ran a nonprofit that was national group? Yeah, national group. And then came to independent sector in the last couple of years as the president and CEO. So remind our listeners about independent sector itself. And if you will, share a little bit about what brought you kind of from that issue-focused work to a place like independent sector.
So a couple things. One is I worked at the foundation for many years, and I will say this. I did spend the bulk of my career working in community development work. But when I started at the foundation, I started doing work around transitioning foster care. And I think that's the beautiful part about a career, and a career particularly in the nonprofit sector, is that you can experience so many different perspectives about social and human life through your career experiences. And so getting to work with young people in foster care, spending the next sort of 15 years of my life in community development and housing, and not just doing it from one perspective. So I did a lot of work around health, right? Health equity, because I'm a culture of health fellow. I did work with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation in one of their national program offices, focusing on childhood obesity, but we had a focus on community, you know? And so I really have enjoyed, you know, my career when you can step back from it and look at it sort of retrospectively, because I have always been deeply curious about community life, people, inequality, and justice. And so I think those things have fueled me. And first of all, I'm really excited about being at independent sector. And I'm excited because I remember attending independent sector conferences and their trainings when I was at Community Foundation, when we were working on issues around EPIP. I remember I used to come to the independent sector conferences and really sort of got some really, you know, good mentoring, met people that were further along in their career. And so I was just excited about coming to a place that in a lot of ways helped shape me as a professional, like a lot of things do. So independent sector is the only national membership organization that brings together the collective civil society, right? So we bring together philanthropy, we bring together human service organizations or client-facing nonprofits, large, medium, small, and we bring together researchers, we bring together policymakers to the table. So we bring together all the various players around civil society. And so I am very proud and honored to be leading independent sector into its next chapter.
Fantastic. I am so excited. I'm there with you. I'm there for you. I'm thrilled that your leadership is there at IS for short, independent sector. And yeah, similarly, I remember going to the conference, the independent sector conference, now rebranded as Upswell, but going to that conference and kind of seeing all these people, as you were saying, across multiple issue areas and kind of connecting into this wider sector beyond one place or one issue area, and kind of seeing how it all connects. I'm pleased to introduce our season 6 sponsor, Loftus Partners. Are you frustrated with a lack of progress on equitable pay in your organization? Look no further than Loftus Partners, your go-to source for human resources consulting with a unique twist. Loftus Partners is not just a consulting firm. They are a 100% woman-owned powerhouse at the intersection of HR, organizational development, and social justice, with a focus on nonprofits. They've launched the Pay Equity Collective, a peer learning experience that provides capacity building, strategic resources, and a supportive community for nonprofits seeking pathways to pay equity. Visit payequitycollective.com to learn more. Loftus Partners, empowering organizations and advancing equity one collective step at a time. So, since you've been in this president and CEO role at independent sector, you've been on a listening tour. What have you been hearing about the nonprofit workforce?
So I think a couple of things. One is that when I started the listening tour, I've been here for about 14 months. And so one of the first things I wanted to do, because, you know, when you start, people are always asking you, like, well, you know, what's your vision, right? Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to sort of put a vision out there before I talked to the field about it. And so in my first year, on top of everything else you do when you start a new position, especially something as large and complex as independent sector, I decided to go out and talk to people. The thing that I love to do, you know, in my life, right? And if you're a community organizer, you know, you can't organize anybody without talking and engaging with them. And so I have visited probably 9 cities and talked to over 500 nonprofit leaders. And again, from all walks of life, that's philanthropy, that's human service organizations, environmental organizations, civil rights organizations, anybody that is part of this independent sector. And I didn't go with sort of a clear mandate, like we want to work on the nonprofit workforce. I just asked people, what keeps you up at night? And Rusty, when I tell you, there's stuff keeping our nonprofit leaders up at night.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And one of the things that I heard from city after city has been the workforce. So I'll tell you a couple of different things, because the workforce is big. What do you mean, Akilah, nonprofit workforce? One is, you know, there's some intergenerational differences that we're experiencing. There are about 4 or 5 different generations working in any given office today. And each generation has an ethos to it, right? And so that's sort of one, but it's normal. It's just sort of like, you know, normal friction that happens. I think the other thing that I heard is that a lot of nonprofit leaders are just like, it's more expensive to operate organizations today than it ever was. And funding isn't matching the growing administrative and operational costs that nonprofits are facing. So things like health insurance, you know, and health insurance is even more of a huge issue. And the reason why I shared my mentor's passing is because this is a very deep and personal issue, even for me, because I know how important it is to take care of the people that take care of everyone else, right? A lot of our nonprofit members were telling us, you know, their premiums, their health insurance premiums have went up as much as 60% in one calendar year.
Wow.
And how are nonprofits, you know, going to manage through that? And as people are coming back from COVID, they're coming back with long COVID, and we don't even know what that means, you know, sort of long sort of impacts from COVID that we're not really sure about what the physical and mental consequences are. People are coming back, at least we're hearing from our constituents, people are coming back with more exhaustion, more mental health challenges. So Rusty, nonprofit leaders are having to hold just more challenges from the workforce and rising costs with inflation and coming out of COVID and our healthcare system being what it is, and less dollars. And so I heard that everywhere I went. And then the other thing I heard was really around sort of leadership. You know, do we have enough people ready to assume leadership positions? You know, the sector still has roughly about 20% of it that are baby boomers. And so they're going to be retiring within the next 10 years. And do we have folks being prepared, trained, having the necessary experiences they need in order to be ready to assume leadership? And leadership is, in some ways, has morphed a bit today than where it used to be 10 or 15 years ago. So, and I think leaders or next in line leaders are feeling it. And then the last thing I will say is this whole ideal around equity and justice, racial equity and justice. You know, one of the things that I love about the independent sector as a sector is that we are diverse. Now, one thing that we do struggle with is that our diversity is not in line with who we serve. And we know that that is a challenge for the sector. But what we do know is that our sector is diverse, not as diverse as it needs to be, especially around leadership. And as our sector is becoming more diverse, we're getting even more and more attacks on our sector as it relates to, you know, BIPOC leadership, BIPOC funding, and, you know, programs and scholarships and such that actually focus on the BIPOC community. So these, we're hearing a lot. I'm hearing a lot as I'm going on the listening tour. So 9 cities, different populations, and everybody is talking about the nonprofit workforce.
Wow. I think it really has risen to the top of the agenda for so many people in a way that it might have been like second or third or maybe fourth in line below fundraising or other things in the past. Now, you know, things have intensified with our workforce, as you say. I hadn't thought of it from that perspective of, you know, it's more expensive to run an organization these days. And with inflation, you know, dollars have less value as well. Yeah, certainly the exhaustion, the mental health challenges, the experiences people are going through in their lives and jobs, I think has intensified. So, you know, one thing I've tried to push back on this podcast and elsewhere is the notion that we don't have enough people or leadership. And so I think, you know, there's so many more Aquilas and Rustys and out there, you know, 14-year-olds who are excited to make change and to be part of something if they knew it existed and if it welcomed them and made those jobs and leadership opportunities available when they're 14 or 18 or 25 or 22 or whatever. And we have so many great people in the sector already who are just itching to do more if they can get the support and mentorship and resources to do that. So I've really struggled with that. How do we frame that in an asset-based way rather than a deficit way? Curious to hear your thoughts on that.
I think you are having the right conversation, right, about is leadership, especially now, really about not being able to find the Rustys and Aquilas, or is it about lack of support? And I want to sort of stretch it, right? I want to sort of stretch the continuum of options here. So I will say this, when we do poll, and we haven't done this at Independent Sector, this is other work I've done in the field around looking at, you know, leadership opportunities. When we do ask people, people are like, hey, yeah, I want to become a leader. I do. I want to lead. If I knew I was going to be supported and I was going to have a supportive board. So that's one, right? That people are saying that they want to lead. And I want to be clear, leadership is hard. Leadership is really hard. And I think if we want to be fair in some ways, we need to, get people sort of ready and trained for what that means, and then also make sure that the infrastructure around them can support them, because you know, boards play a big part in how much support any leader feels. You know, staff, we can go either way, but having a strong sort of board support and funder support, because that's the other thing that we're reading about, Rusty, is that a lot of, especially as BIPOC leaders are rising in prominence, we're actually seeing how funding in some of those cases aren't following the BIPOC leader. And that becomes really challenging, especially for the leader, for the organization, and for the boards, right? So those are things that keep me up at night. And I think the third thing, Rusty, if we can, you know, if we can be absolutely honest, there are a lot of demands on people's time. One of the things that in some ways we're looking at, we know that our sector, we have the third largest private employer in the country. The independent sector is, right? The nonprofit sector. That's 12 and a half million Americans. That's pretty strong. And that counts, that's roughly about 6% of GDP.
And that doesn't even count all our volunteer power. That's just paid staff.
that's paid staff, and we can talk about volunteers. So we are a very formidable sector. We contribute a lot. We contributed in 2022, we contributed to about $1.4 trillion to the American economy. So we're very strong, we're robust, and 2/3 of the sector are women. And we have to have these conversations. And 2/3 of the sector are women. And so when we're thinking about leadership and the demands of leadership, we also need to look at what space and room and opportunity leadership provides, especially women, if we think about the sector, it being 2/3, and sort of what supports we can put around all of our leaders to be successful, and BIPOC leaders to be successful, and especially women of color who are BIPOC leaders. You know, I'm a mother of three, which also I took 6 years out of the workforce to stay home with kids because I couldn't afford daycare and working. And a lot of women who have to take the responsibility of childcare and sometimes elderly and parent care, they have to hold both of those. And leadership is a very demanding thing. So I think there are some things that we can do as a sector to make sure that leaders are supported. And I think simultaneously, there's some things we have to work on structurally as a society to make sure that women can be strong, women have all the opportunities and freedom, and don't have to make those hard choices around family or work.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you stretching out the continuum of what's happening in terms of, do we have enough people and do enough support for people, especially people of color, women of color, coming into leadership roles? I think, you know, the research from Building Movement Project has shown that people of color are ready to lead, are qualified to lead, want to lead, and are facing racist barriers to moving up in the into executive positions. And that has been, I think, such an important reframe or framing of the issue. And then they just came out with this report that basically leadership roles are unappealing, unattractive to people of color. So people are moving away from wanting those roles. So I think there's all these tensions around what's happening in the sector with leadership and leaders of color being called upon to take on executive roles, to succeed white people in some of those roles, and how those things are playing out in different ways is a really serious issue going on in the sector right now.
It's a huge issue, Rusty. It's a huge issue.
So one of the things we wanted to get into here is you've convened some meetings. I had the honor to be part of one last summer. And you all have been, your team has been studying, you know, what's happening with the workforce. And one of the things that you all identified was this gap in federal tax incentives that are available to for-profit businesses to help incentivize supports for their staff, for them hiring veterans and other people who may be on the margins of the economy for one reason or another. Those businesses are getting those tax incentives or have them available to them, and nonprofits don't have the same incentives from the government. So I wondered if you could share a little bit more about what that's all about, why, and give us some examples, because I think people listening may not have heard about this.
Rusty, thank you for teeing this up. So one of the things we wanted to do after we've heard all this data about, you know, we need help with the nonprofit workforce, is one of the things we do really well here in independent sector is public policy and advocacy work. And I'm more than happy to talk more about that, because part of our job here is to defend the sector and make sure that the sector is strong, healthy, and just. And so one of the things that we did do was, looking at this nonprofit workforce issue, was scour the tax code and see exactly what are the hiring incentives, what are the tax incentives that the for-profit industry has that the nonprofit industry could benefit from, but for whatever reason, we don't have it. And so we spent months doing that, again, being really responsive to what we're hearing. And what we came away with after that process is we've identified 6 different tax credits that we feel that the nonprofit sector should have access to, and that could help us be more competitive in the labor market. Because that's the other major issue we're facing, Rusty, is competition for really high levels of human capital in this current labor market. It's scarce. And corporations, they have a much deeper pockets than the nonprofit sector. So, for example, we found about six of the tax credits. I'll give you a few examples. One is early childhood tax credits, right? I talked about being a mother of three children and how hard it is to find daycare. If nonprofits had access to an early childhood tax credit, we could actually open daycares on sites for parents and be able to have a tax credit that is levied against our payroll taxes, which we pay quarterly because we get that sometimes. Well, nonprofits don't pay taxes. That's the reason why they don't have a tax benefit. And I'm like, no, nonprofits pay a lot of taxes. We pay them in the form of payroll taxes quarterly. And so that's one of the examples we looked at. And so we're right now, we are, well, I'll tell you a little bit about what we're doing with the tax incentive programs. There's a lot of other opportunities. If you think about something like mileage, if you are doing anything on behalf of your organization, you know, you have a mileage rate that the IRS gives you. And that, you know, rate is in line with what gas costs and those sorts of things. But if you're a volunteer and you're sort of, you know, taking a patient to go get treatment or taking them to go vote or get their shot, you're only reimbursed up to about 10 cents a mile. And so you don't have, we don't have equity across the sector, even around something as simple as mileage reimbursement. I'll give you a third one because this one always surprises people. One is hard to employ Americans. Nonprofits usually don't use that language, but that's the language that's, you know, currently in our code, our tax code. And so for-profit companies, there are about six different categories of Americans that if they hired from that category, they're able to get a tax credit. And nonprofits, we only have one category, that is veterans. And it's partly because the Veterans Administration really pushed for that. But nonprofits, you know, we hire Americans from all walks of life. We hire Americans with all sorts of different cognitive abilities, and we don't get any sort of tax credit for that, even though we're doing it. It's just part of what we do. And so those are the sort of tax credits that we have been looking at. And so we identified several of them, and then we also analyze them through a racial equity analysis because we don't want to put forth any policies that have an inherent harm to communities of color or any community for that instance. So, you know, as a sector, one of the things that it's important for us to do is realize we have a collective identity, right? So part of the reason why, you know, people are always asking, you know, how come we never did this before? Like, this feels like we should have done this years ago. Mm-hmm. And part of it is having this collective identity, right? So if you are LLC, you know, a business, you belong to the SBA, they're a very powerful union or association, rather. We didn't really have that as a civil society, right? We haven't sort of thought about ourselves as sort of one collective entity. And so that's one of the things I, you know, my goals at Independent Sector will be is for the sector to realize that we are a sector and that we matter and we have a lot of value to this country. And there are things that this sector has worked for and has earned that we need to go get. And that's part of what I'm doing. And the meeting you attended a few months ago, Rusty, is us organizing so we can go and get, you know, the tax incentives, political representation, you know, all the things that we need to be healthy, strong, and competitive as a sector.
So given the situation with Congress not doing particularly too much these days, what's the status with this or how are you thinking about making these changes?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I can see how people can look at Congress and feel like there isn't a lot of progress happening. I will say a couple of things around what our public policy and advocacy strategy has been. One is that we meet with the current White House very frequently, a couple times a month. And these are the issues that we bring to the White House so they can become educated. So part of our job is to educate policymakers on why this is an important issue. The other thing is that the next part of our job is to shop these different tax incentive proposals to Congress. And we shop them both Republicans and Democrats and independents, because we are nonpartisan here in the independent sector. And to be honest with you, Rusty, we're getting a lot of great traction, right? Everybody wants to see Americans working. And so this is not a partisan issue per se. Now, why people want to see it, the sort of outcomes of it, you know, we can sort of talk about that. But we at Independent Sector really try to not get into the partisan sort of wars. And we really want to work with very smart policymakers that want the best for Americans. And I think we're getting some really good traction across the aisles around this particular work, because it is about getting Americans back to work. It is about making sure that the nonprofit sector is represented at tables as it relates to labor, as it relates to the civil society. And it's also important because, again, so much of our job is educating policymakers about how we're a sector, the contributions we make. So really good data is so important, which is why we do our sector health report annually. It is so important to communicate the value of the sector.
Yeah, totally. I totally agree with you there. It's really disturbing how little our elected representatives and the staff people working in government at, you know, at all levels don't understand our sector. So definitely grateful to have you and Independent Sector at those tables doing that education work. And I hope you or someone from IS will keep us informed of the progress so we can help folks know, hopefully when some of those tax incentives do get put into place, hopefully in the near future. So you mentioned the state of the health of the sector. Can you tell folks a little bit about that product and any other projects or materials that they can find on your website or that will be coming out soon?
So the Sector Health Report is work that Independent Sector, we have led on this for many, many years, and we want to monitor social trust, right? So that is sort of the clearest way to describe it. So we are very, very interested in how healthy the sector is, how organizations are faring, how Americans view the nonprofit sector in relation to other institutions. We're very interested in issues such as how Americans are trusting the sector. Trust is our social capital in our work. And I think that's one of the things that makes me incredibly, incredibly proud to be part of the independent sector. One of the challenges that we are seeing is that we are seeing declines in social trust, especially as it relates to the nonprofit sector. We have lost about 7 trust points since about 2020, and that is very disturbing to us. Now, I want to just say in context that all other sort of institutions have lost trust too, and there's some that have well below sort of 50%. And the nonprofit sector is one of the most trusted institutions. It's us and small businesses. And so the fact that we have lost and we are statistically significant around that worries us. And it's something we're paying attention to because it has ramifications for volunteer time. It has ramifications for individual donor contributions, which are down. Volunteer time is down. It's the, you know, one of the first times we've seen this. Volunteer time has dipped down below 50%. This is something we're really, really paying attention to. We've seen individual donations, you know, to the country's 1.8 million nonprofits decline by, a minimum 10% when we control for inflation. So these are things that we're paying a lot of attention to, Rusty, and we should be worried as a society, which is why so much, at least of my work, is about making sure we have a strong and healthy sector, protecting the sector, educating policymakers about the importance of the nonprofit sector and how we deeply contribute to the fabric of American life. This is why we have to beat the drum and have to have a very strong narrative about who we are, especially as we are doing a lot more policy mobilization.
Yeah, I mean, that's really stunning data about trust. So I want to make sure folks know, my understanding is you have a sort of quarterly health of the nonprofit sector, as well as an annual report. Is that correct?
Yes, so we do. And we invite people to go to our website at www.independentsector.org. You will be able to get our sector health report. The annual sort of lays out, we have executive summaries too for folks that don't want to sort of go into pages and pages and tables, but it's a really good report and it is absolutely worth a read. And I'm not just saying it because I run the place, but rather because this is a great piece of information to help us as a sector best strategize. We also offer quarterly sector health reports. And these are just snapshots because, again, we are tracking this in real time. So we invite people to go to our website and learn all about that information. You know, you also asked, Rusty, you know, what else is happening? So we have sector health. We also will be having convenings across the country. The listening tour is not over. It ends at the end of Q1. So we're doing a listening tour. If you're in Phoenix, if you're in Los Angeles or Washington, D.C., we are coming to your city in the next few weeks. Please go to our website to learn more about it. If you're not going to be in any of those cities, but you still want to weigh in, and that's the other thing I want to be clear about. We are working on the nonprofit workforce because it is such an important issue everywhere we've went. But there are other issues that we are working on here at Independent Sector. And we want people to know that anybody that attends any of our listening tours, there is still plenty of space and opportunity for you to contribute your voice. If you're not going to be in any of the cities that I mentioned, we will be offering a virtual option for the listening tour. And we really want to encourage people to sign up and join and talk directly to me about, you know, what keeps them up at night and what are they hopeful for. So please go to our website to learn more.
All right. Fantastic. So that's www.independentsector.org. And we'll put a link in the show notes as well. We'll link to the sector health reports as well directly. And any other resources you want to share, we will throw those up in the show notes as well with links. So thank you, Akilah, for being here and for bringing the force of your leadership to the independent sector.
I really appreciate it, Rusty, for the invite and also just chopping it up with an old friend. So Rusty and I, we have about 25 years. That. Yeah, between us. I also want to encourage anybody that's interested in learning more about Independent Sector or becoming a member of Independent Sector to please go to our website and to click on membership. We are an amazing organization to join. You're going to be part of a full community, again, of foundation leaders, nonprofit leaders, policymakers, academics. We are a full-on community and one of the oldest sort of national membership models created for this purpose, to hold the center of the civil society. So I'm excited. And thank you, Rusty, for giving me an opportunity to just, again, chop it up with you and also talk to your listeners about the exciting work happening at the independent sector.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Akilah. Well, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Akilah Watkins. She's amazing. And I'm so thankful that she took the time to be here. And glad to see the direction she's going in with Independent Sector. Next week here on Fund the People podcast, we've got another incredible guest. Beth Cantor is here, one of our field's experts on artificial intelligence, on nonprofit tech, and on wellness and well-being in the nonprofit sector. In fact, she's written books about both of those things, tech and wellness in our sector. You got to listen. Beth Kanter's here next week on Fund the People podcast. I'll talk to you then. Thanks for listening to Fund the People podcast. Visit fundthepeople.org and click on podcast to find a transcript for this and other episodes and all the links discussed in the episode. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate a 5-star rating and a quick review, if possible, on Apple Podcasts. It helps more people to find the show. Thank you for driving change in our communities. Remember to keep your tank full. Take care of yourself and take care of one another.